It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
Alright, hopefully it's working good today. Alright, yes, it seems to. Okay, so, this morning I invented a brand new game, or I think of it as a show, for my wife, called This Is the Man You Married. And there have been two episodes so far, both today now. And the first one was early in the morning when I said, "This is the man you married." I said, when we were getting ready, I had been eating breakfast and stuff, and I came in to get ready while she's getting ready. And I said, earlier this morning, I think I was worried about something, but I can't remember what it was, and now I'm worried about that. And then as we were leaving work, I said, "This is another episode of This is the Man You Married."
Another episode.
As she already knew, sometimes if I have a really bad day at work, even though I know it's not a healthy decision or whatever, to make myself feel better, I will buy ice cream. We have these little micro markets in our building where you can buy snacks and pre-made sandwiches and stuff. And there's a freezer that has some ice cream treats, and I'll buy one if I'm feeling bad, make myself feel better. Today I was not feeling bad. I had a very good day at work, so to celebrate, I bought some ice cream. So this has been This is the Man You Married, but only if you're Trish. So.
Pretty limited audience there.
Yes. But to be fair, this is the man that only she married. So, I mean, truth in advertising.
So, what's the Nielsen rating on this show?
Trish watched both times.
Well,
so
that's
I mean,
the whole demographic right
yes,
there.
Yes,
100%.
Yes. It's a very low overall rating. But we are getting 100% of our key demographic.
What you need to do...
I can't swear she was paying attention, but the channel was turned on, and that's really all we care about.
I think that there are probably businesses local that would like her business. So say, hey, if you give me some money, I'll make sure I mention you in my episode of...
So this morning I thought I was worried about something, and Ace Hardware has great deals on anything you need. Also, this is funny you should mention this, though, because shortly before you showed up, I was watching YouTube, and the ad was for PetSmart, because PetSmart has a Labor Day weekend sale.
Okay.
Which struck me as a little weird that they would have a sale based on a three-day weekend that was significant enough that they felt the need to advertise on TV. I don't know. Maybe it's because I don't shop at pet stores a lot, but it was weird to me. But anyway, what I heard was that they were having a sale where it was like 20% off or something, all poison treats. So I looked up because I was not looking up at the time. All toys and treats.
Toys and treats.
But I'm telling you, they said it very quickly and run together. I feel like when they were recording this, somebody should have been like, you know what? Let's say treats and toys. Because it sounded like you were saying poison treats. And A, we don't sell those. And B, people aren't going to want to buy them.
They probably think it rolls off the tongue better, toys and treats.
It does. Just like one would say poison treats.
Yeah, that rolls off the tongue too.
It does. I'm not... This is a linguistic observation. It is not an endorsement of the concept. This is purely phonetic. Yeah. I guess they were so delighted with that aspect that they were like, you know what? I'll take the backlash.
Yeah, we'll just roll the dice on this.
Just fun to say.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the trick. In the recording, they're not actually saying toys and treats. They're saying poison treats. But they're like, go ahead. We dare you.
If you put the right lettering up, people will hear it right.
Yeah, it's a trick.
But if you're not looking... Then you get the truth.
I find it out. It's conspiracy goes all the way up to the top. What conspiracy? They're not actually selling poison treats. No, but they're saying it. Just fuck with me. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat Podcast, the only podcast in the world that knows the truth about PetSmart and their commercials. They're linguistically amusing, but deadly, linguistically speaking, commercials. Yep. I'm Tony.
And I'm William, and this is episode 442.
You could use that with anything that starts with toys and... Santa Claus brings lots of poison gifts to the boys and girls.
Yeah, I guess so.
Shopping spree where you can buy lots of poison candy. Man. What episode number did you say this was? I already wasn't
442.
Listening. 442.
It was easy to remember because...
Is that like a gross or something? No, that's like... No. 144 or something. Is it gross?
Yeah, whatever 12 times 12 is.
That's 144.
No, 400. The reason I could remember 442 is because that number has a special significance to people who are fans of Oldsmobiles.
Really?
I won't get into it because I don't completely understand it. My family is a big Oldsmobile family, I probably said. My dad's first car was an Oldsmobile. His grandfather bought it for him, insisted that he have an Oldsmobile. And out of all of us kids, probably the biggest Oldsmobile fan is my youngest brother. He's a big fan of Ranson E. Olds, the guy that Oldsmobiles are named after. He's got a lot of Oldsmobile stuff at his house, and he likes to restore Oldsmobiles. He restored an Oldsmobile, sold it, and now he's bought a whole new Oldsmobile to restore. That's just what he does. But one of the... he likes older models, like in the 70s and 80s, and he likes... he likes models that are 442s. I think that's like it's an engine and maybe
a dessert topping.
No, it's like a package. So like you could have a Cutlass or you could have a 98, but it could be a 442, meaning it's got a specific engine in it.
And like other ones, they're like it's an SE or whatever.
Yeah. Okay. It's got a certain engine and why can't I remember the name of it? You know, the thing you shift. Transmission. but that's his favorite kind of car.
Okay, just wanted to stop you for a second because I know very little about cars. And yet, point of fact, the transmission, you don't shift. It's a clutch that you shift. If it's a transmission, that means it's automatic.
Well, but I think these are automatic transmissions.
But then you don't shift. The car does it.
Oh, that's what I meant.
I just wanted to be pedantic about cars because... This is literally the only time in my life I will ever be able to be pedantic about cars.
Well, and I'm probably getting it all wrong because...
I don't care about anything you said. I just wanted to make that
point. Out of everybody in the family, I probably know the least about cars in general, much less Oldsmobiles. I've never even owned one. But my younger brother loves them, and he likes this type of kind of car where it's a 442. And so, like...
Well, youngest right boy...
His email address... Address G-Wright 442, you know, that's
is
much
dedicated
it.
To you.
and
now I'm going to talk about Chevys because you reminded me.
Oh, okay. We've had Chevys too. Vans, usually.
The producer and I recently saw something and we don't fully understand it. It was a car. The back windshield of the car was a sticker, a decal, or whatever. It is of a type I've seen many times before. Commemorating a dead loved one.
Oh, okay.
Had a person's name, and it had the year born and death in it.
Okay.
And something properly epitaph-ish. The thing is, the name, and maybe the year, I don't know, but the name and, like, the center part of this was inside of the Chevy emblem.
Okay.
What the hell?
Oh, man. I mean, some people relate very heavily to a particular brand of, well, like my brother, Oldsmobiles.
That they essentially want their grave marker to have that car's...
Sure, yeah.
Wow.
Usually if it's a person that clearly has an affinity for Chevrolets or Fords, that they probably always had Chevy trucks or they always had Ford trucks.
Okay.
It's usually pickup trucks. But, there are some people that are fiercely loyal to a brand of automobile. Fiercely loyal.
All right. When I die, I want a memorial sticker that has my name and everything, and then a cartoon of Calvin peeing on me. Because assuming I don't die soon, I am confident that will be within the mainstream by the time. No pun intended. I apologize. By the time I'm dead.
I mean, I don't think my brother would want like a gravestone that's the shape of the Oldsmobile logo or whatever. But I think if he saw one somewhere in a cemetery, he'd think like, it was pretty cool.
I get it.
Yeah.
He'd be like, word.
I mean, you know, you probably wouldn't have been surprised to see a similar thing in maybe some sports logo, right? Like, oh, this person was a huge sports fan, and so that's why they're incorporating this in. I mean, would that have...
No, you're right, and I'm very sad about that. And I would have been very sad, but I would have been like, no, that tracks with my view of America. I was trying to put the best face on it I could, and the best I could come up with was a longtime employee of Chevy, and when he died, the employer gave them this. But well, that felt weird, too. It's like, we're so sorry for your loss. Have this windshield sticker commemorating him.
Some people have really incredible brand loyalty.
Well, what's hilarious is I realized I didn't check the make of the car.
Oh.
So it'd be really funny if it wasn't a Chevy.
Like a Toyota or something.
Yeah, that would be great.
Nissan.
Ford. That would be nice.
Ford would actually be worse than a foreign.
No, that's exactly. Yeah. I was like, yeah, no, that's the worst. That's the anti-Chevy.
Yeah.
Do you have
any brands that you feel loyal to? Not loyal like that maybe, but just, yeah, I kind of like this brand, and until they really tick me off, I'm going to use this brand.
No. I have preferences in some things, in a lot of things I don't. But I have, like, for whatever particular product, I prefer to get this kind of thing.
Hmm.
But I don't have brand loyalty, per se.
Okay.
Like a... Because it doesn't make sense to me.
Not like a fandom either? Because that's kind of a brand loyalty thing in a way. Depending.
Yeah. Well, that's how I'm trying to translate. I'm like, is there some, like, book thing or whatever... And I will admit there are things from fantasy stories that at certain points in my life I have considered if I was going to get a tattoo, I would do that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But not nowadays. Nowadays I'm like, no, I don't
think
so.
Is there anything like for you like Discworld is to Stu? Because he clearly is.
I don't know. I don't know. I feel like such a window. I talked to him about that today. I'm like, I feel like such a window. And he's like, well, I was way into Star Wars before that and stuff. But like in terms of reading... Yeah, like, we clearly opened something there inside of him.
But that's all right.
I
mean, it's okay to have something like that.
It is. I feel like he may have inadvertently put some spoilers in there. People frequently do spoilers that they don't realize are spoilers.
Yeah.
Because it's things where it's just a piece of data, and then one can use deductive or abductive reasoning and put the rest together.
Yeah, right.
And he said a couple things, and I'm like, oh, since he said that, that probably means this, which probably means this.
Oh, I didn't understand any of it.
I did a fair bit, because I have looked into this stuff before, and I'm a little familiar. And also, I'm halfway through that book. But for those of you just joining us, we're here talking about stuff that you're so obsessed about, you want a windshield sticker of it after you're dead. No, here's how the show really works. We have a hat. It's magic. And that it has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Folks, good people, good folks who like to help us out when we're desperate, which is now, write in to that address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com, with little notes, comments, topics, questions, things like that. The hat, all on its own, magically, transmogrifies those emails into little note cards with the information written physically on them that manifest, with the information written on them that manifest physically within the hat itself. It's even pretty sad for podcasters, servants draw the note cards out of the hat at random, read them on the air, talk about them till we're bored, do that for about an hour. That's the whole show except the parts that aren't, which is most of it.
Yep.
So, I'd ask you how your week was, but I already know the most exciting part.
Yeah, I read your book.
You are the only person in the world who has read both of the last two drafts, and I believe you said it was a perfect piece of literature, I believe was the words you used.
Not exactly what I said. What I did say was, there were typos and such in it, as you've pointed out yourself, mm-hmm. and those things need to be addressed. And maybe a few other things, if you read through it again, you might tweak and polish here and there. I didn't think that it was going to need a full-fledged rewrite.
Tris has suggested she read it to me out loud so I really hear it from somebody else's delivery.
That's a good idea.
I'm thinking about that.
That's a good idea.
But mostly right now I'm just going to wait and see what editors. I'm not sure how many editors will come back this time because I'm calmer now, so I'm not going to get on people about helping me out for free. But just, yeah, not a lot of response from people. Now, some of it is a lot of people involved have children who only just started going back to school.
Mm-hmm.
But so we'll see what happens. But I'm busy right now anyway, working on Becky James Lowenstein, which, as of this morning, I am no longer writing the first person interstitial part right now.
Oh.
I realized it's not. The other part is going to inform it way too much.
So you can't do one and then the other.
I can, but like it's sort of pointless because just such a huge amount of it is going to be rewritten based on what I write.
That's right.
And so I started writing the real thing, and I wrote the first chapter, and for the first time, like, ever, I wrote the very first draft of it, and I'm pleased.
Well, that's good.
I mean, it's very early, and it's going to change. And it's possibly because that scene has been in my head for, like, years at this point, but I was really happy about it. And it's so funny, because I talked about this before, it's sci-fi, and so there's a lot of naming of things. When you just fucking start writing, it comes much faster.
Mm.
Like, characters would show up and they needed a name. And because they'd shown up and now I had them clearly in my head, they got a name real fast. Whereas before, when it was something outside and I was like, okay, what's going to be the name for this person?
Yeah.
It was way harder.
The reading it the second time around, it was very much like reading it the first time. I mean, There were moments where
it was so forgettable last time.
No, it was so there was so much more to it.
A lot of things changed, and there are several thousand more words.
Yeah, and I think the thing I like best about it that I don't feel like came through that much in the first draft, but came through really well in the second. It's probably something that only me and people like me will notice, and that is, the fact that she's an anthropology major didn't seem like just some throwaway fact. Mm-hmm. It seemed like a critical part of how she saw things, how she observed things, and the way she dealt with things. Because she commented on these things once in a while. So it's like I really get a sense that this is not just a sort of a fact that you learn early on and it doesn't mean anything after that. You kind of get some insight into her whole personality as you go through it. And I know that's what you studied too, so that's a little bit of your own personality coming through also.
But you saw more of that in the second one?
Yeah, and when I read it the first
time...
That's
interesting, because that was not conscious on my part. I'm willing to believe it happened, but...
Because the first time, I think maybe even one of the things I said in my feedback was I'm curious to know more about her thought process here and her thought, you know, what she's thinking and, you know.
Well, and this may have dovetailed with other complaints, because the complaint I got in several places was that the protagonist is being very, is taking a lot of really weird shit just in stride all the time. And they weren't wrong. And I wanted to make that more expressive, and it was hard for me to do. So what it translated to, and I think this is legit, because again, this is a behavior that I have had in my life, is that she would just sort of try and go along with it, but then periodically just lose her shit over it. And I was really good at writing those moments. And a lot of that is her basically just laundry listing all the impossible crap she's just had to go through, or all the impossible crap that they have just tried to argue to her and stuff like that. And I suppose those fit in together in places.
Yeah. Well, a lot of that and other things, observations she made about certain things, it all kind of comes together to you learn how she thinks rationally about things. And you can tell that she's got an open mind about things, and, you know, and, you know, she talks about being pansexual and all that, but that's not the only reason she's an open-minded person.
No.
Like she's got a broad perspective on things. And to me personally, I can tie that directly to her being an anthropology major. Now, some people might not make that connection, but,
like me.
What?
Like me.
Well, but I did, and I really liked it.
Yeah.
I really appreciated it.
No, I think that's probably just too ingrained to me that I didn't see it, because she is based a lot on me. And I don't know. I'm going to be really curious to see how Becca James comes out versus that, because I noticed this when I was writing the first person Becca James stuff. She sounds an awful lot like Carolyn.
Oh.
And she very much is not. They are very different characters.
Well, I...
And so I'm trying to work on that. And I'm going to be curious how effective I am at that.
Well, I don't know if this will help you to know or not. But also in the second draft, I could sense you in both Rebecca and Carolyn.
Yeah, Rebecca's heavily on me too.
But I didn't hear you. I heard them.
Good. That's wonderful. That's,
you know,
wonderful.
What I'm saying?
Yes.
I mean, I got that you were in there somewhere.
Yeah.
But it wasn't you. It was them, and they were very distinct from you, I thought.
I went and saw a play this last weekend that a friend was in, and afterwards I told her, I said, you did a marvelous job. And I know you did a marvelous job, and that it's not just me being biased, and I'll tell you why. Half the time, I forgot it was you.
Yeah, that's right.
And I'm like, and that's how you know you did it. I had to do a lot by record. The ending was huge. The ending needed a ton of work. And a lot of people were almost angry about certain parts of the ending before.
Mm.
And so I cleaned up a lot of things there. I also discovered, which I sort of had guessed, dialogue's my thing. So there were a lot of places where I put more banter in,
mm-hmm,
because that's my strength.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that fit in a lot of places. I hope I did well by Rebecca in this version. I did not do well by her before.
See, that's another thing. I couldn't remember in the first reading, I didn't get a very full sense of her, but in this one, she was a very full-fledged and well-drawn character, and I got a good sense of who she was, and I liked her. I didn't dislike her before, but I didn't really feel like I got to know her.
Especially near the end, she was just the object.
Yeah.
I did really poorly on that the first time. And, as you mentioned, so we've been debating the way I ended it the first time in terms of their potential relationship, of not getting them together, but then having a little epilogue that says they did, or waiting until the next book to get them together. And I was trying to vacillate between those two options.
Mm.
And then I suddenly was like, oh, wait. I could also just get them together now. And I felt like it worked.
I don't even remember how the original draft ended, but I thought the ending on this was really good.
It was basically when Carolyn explains why they can't be together, Rebecca basically accepts that in the first version.
So then
but then I have a couple paragraphs that are like, yeah, that didn't last very long. And people felt weird about that because they kind of felt cheated.
Oh, well, I mean...
And this one I felt gave you that. But it also explains it pretty well, because through the whole thing, I'm like, this is still a kind of whirlwind romance. And I don't want it to ring false because it takes place over such a short period of time.
Oh, but some dramatic things are happening too.
Which can be a component as well.
I mean, of course, the end of the draft was what I read today, so I remember it fairly well. Rebecca had a very specific response to Carolyn. Was that not in the first draft?
No. No, Rebecca's response. I mean, there's stuff in there about Rebecca, like saying, like, I need to stand up for myself and all, like that bit was in there.
Yeah.
But she was essentially agreeing with Carolyn. She's like, yeah, that's fine. We can.
I thought her response in this was really good.
Yeah.
Like, very effective emotionally.
And
even.
I'm still, and people get weird, and I shortened the age difference between them in this one.
I didn't.
It was
remember.
Bigger. Carolyn's slightly older. Rebecca's slightly younger. But I still very much wanted to make a point that Rebecca is older and, like, has got a little more shit figured out.
Sure, sure.
And I thought in that section was a good part of that. Because I feel like she had a better perspective on, like, what's happening. I wanted Carolyn's actions to be very sort of knee-jerk to the moment and her to point out, like, that doesn't...
Well, I thought all of the characters were more memorable.
I had to fix the Eugene stuff. Like, that was just too low level later. I was like, this is some serious shit going on. And we kind of just gloss over it.
Oh, did you give that a little more?
Oh, totally. Totally.
It's really good.
Like, they didn't fight at all.
Oh.
Like, she was like, I hate this, but I can't deal with this right now. I have to do the other thing. And he just, like, helped out. And that was it. This time we had the whole, and I was like, this is big. Because people were also saying that. They're like, so Carolyn's just fine with, like, she's just going to leave this forever? And I'm like, no, she's not. That's terrible.
Well,
and Eugene has issues. Eugene is going to be a repeat character.
Well, I got that impression.
I mean, obviously, we had the thing at the end, too. But, like, Eugene's a complicated character that you just don't see yet.
Yeah. No, that was all really good.
And everyone, including you, needed more Abraham.
Yes. Which I liked all of it.
And I put in several fairly large scenes with him that didn't exist before.
That was great. That was great.
And specified his origin, which I totally just forgot to do. Everybody's like, so what is he? I'm like, well, obviously, oh, shit, I didn't write any of that down. Sorry.
No, pretty much all the characters were more interesting and more relatable and more... And you felt something for all of them, whether it was positive or negative.
And I got to give credit to my editors. Much of it is feedback. And it's so hilarious. My mother still can't understand. Because I would talk. She's like, I really like this part. And I'm like, yeah, no, that was terrible the last time. Like, I was doing this wrong or whatever. And she's like, well, I didn't feel that way. And I'm like, no, because you read the fixed one. Like, it was bad. You didn't see that part.
Oh, and I also, I think, had a better appreciation for, like, your world building and the whole idea you had behind, you know, how angels and demons worked and
stuff. I hope so, because there was a lot of confusion the first time.
Yeah.
And I had to get more specific, because I was vague on, like, so what's the difference, and why do we care? And I also had to make them matter more. The Seraphim especially didn't. Like, they were meant to be good and creepy, you know? And the first time I was kind of vague. And this time I'm like, no, Carolyn has specific feelings about this, and you all need to know why.
Yeah, yeah. No, I
And a lot of it, some of it was very specific advice from editors. Like, the whole blood draw scene and, like, the creepy nurse or whatever. Literally, I don't even remember who it was now, but somebody was like, you should have a creepy nurse in here. And then it'll work better. And I'm like, that's right. This is good.
No, I wasn't confused about anything. I understood what was going on. Some of the characters were explaining things, and I liked that personally, but because not only did it help me understand, and it made sense that they'd be explaining it, but those interactions said something about the characters who were explaining it. Like, I never really connected to the character of Michelle at all in the first draft, and in this one I did. And so everything that happened with her was so much more effective.
And, again, thank the editors, because two major things I got was a chunk of people really loved Michelle, which confused me. Because I'm like, she's fine, but why is... Some people are like, she's my favorite character. And I'm like, I don't get that. And a fair number of people were confused about what she was doing.
Mm.
And so those two things combined, I'm like, I need to fill this out more so that, because people like it, and also so people understand it.
Well, it really made the character, I mean, again, so much was revealed about the character just in her trying to explain things or not being able to explain things or admitting that, well, I didn't really have a plan here. You know, it's like this character is so interesting. And so things that happen with her and to her, you care a lot more about, at least I do, than in the first draft. Yeah. So it was just really good. All your changes were so, so good.
And it was almost like so little of what I did was just me saying, you know what, I like this better. Almost all of it is all of y'all saying, like, either being confused by this or not liking this or asking for more of this or less of this. Like, I'm worried because I don't plan to do it that way in the future. I don't plan on getting 20 people to edit me for free. No, but I'm like, it was so much help.
But it
like I definitely need some people to do it.
I really like the world that you've built, and I like the rules that you've established. I like.
I'm glad because I feel like that's a weak spot for me. I'm my world building. I have it in my head, but putting it down in a way that works is tricky. And I constantly am struggling with the show don't tell thing. And that's my cheat. And I mean, it's a common cheat. It happens in TV and movies and stuff too, is I have someone who's confused and then someone else can explain.
Well, I was thinking about that actually after I read it today, the whole show don't tell thing. And people really need to take that sort of as a rule of thumb. When you can show rather than tell, you really should.
Yeah.
But it happens in real life. People tell each other things.
Yes.
And also the way a person tells, there's a lot of character development there and relationship development.
And imperfect and unreliable narration brings it. And that's,
and
that was a lot of the times when I'm explaining stuff, I'm like, I would like this to be in here, but they're going to leave it out. They don't care about this part. Or like, this character is clearly confused about this, so they're going to say it wrong and stuff.
Right,
and that's,
right.
That one of the overwhelming forces in what this series will be is its major fantasy stuff that I'm grounding very heavily in reality in terms of people. And so, like, one of the components of that is there's not going to be any tricky rules and get out of jail free cards. There's not going to be like, oh, the Fae can never lie. Or if these type of person promise something, it's an unbreakable bond. There's none of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you, there's no way to prove people are telling the truth. There's none of that kind of jazz. And part of that is also making them realistic. Even the most powerful beings or whatever, they're not necessarily good at everything.
Right.
They don't their perspective is not necessarily all encompassing.
They're not omniscient.
Exactly.
However powerful they are. So they're going to have a weakness.
Yeah, but I mean, I just want it to be great. They're going to act like a person.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because they're people. Like,
well, I think
I want my immortal angels to be realistic.
I think you've made the right choice to leverage your strength in dialogue, to make that world building stuff that you have to have people actually talk about to make it interesting. You know what I'm saying? And to have it reveal other story elements that are important. I think that was.
And they just have a lot of geeky characters. Like, so much stuff is Carolyn and Rebecca geeking out about stuff.
Yeah.
Frequently in response to stress.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Like, in moments where that's a bad thing to do, but that's, like, their reaction is to sort of, like, analyze it or whatever, or discuss it.
I think it's...
And I'm very happy about that.
It's just
that
really...
You like that.
Yeah, it's just really very clever. I mean, some of the themes that you've got are tried and true themes, but you've got a very original...
Oh, yeah, I play with a lot of tropes.
Yeah, but I think the idea that you're doing with the Nephilim and stuff is really original, and I like it a lot.
So it's going to sit for a few months.
Yeah, that's probably the right thing to do.
Basically, while I'm writing first draft of Becky James.
Yeah.
Once I have probably my very first draft, like my zeroth draft of Becky James, or near that point, I'm gonna start calling an end to this editing period. I'm gonna tell people, like, it's been a few months. If you're gonna send me stuff, you should send it to me. Yeah. Otherwise, it's fine. And then I'll polish it, which I do not expect to take very long.
No, I wouldn't think so either.
And then it's done, and it's done. Like, I can't mess with it anymore. I can't keep working on it. And then, but then I spend some time figuring out exactly, and I've been researching this a little anyway, how you shop them around to agents. And then I do that, which is a matter of just sending stuff out and then waiting forever for all the rejections that you get. Because even if you get, well, you get 1,000 rejections first.
Yeah.
While I go back and work on Becky James some more.
And, you know, if you get someone to take it, they're going to give you feedback too. So you'll probably still be altering it. But I think once you've given it a good polish and fixed some of the obvious problems, I think it's going to be a really strong draft for someone to, you know, to say, hey, I think this has potential. We want to do something with it. And here are some notes, you know, and see what you can do with it. And then that kind of negotiation can start.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's going to be really good.
Going to keep working on other stuff, because if I get an agent, I know people who got a literary agent for their book. Their book sold. They didn't get anything else done quick enough, and their agent dropped them.
Yeah.
And so I got to work on more stuff. And also, like I've said, it can't be about money or anything, so I'm just working.
Yeah.
And if it takes too long, I mean, I'll probably give it a good go, a year or two, you know, of trying to sell it. But if eventually I just get nothing, then it goes on Amazon or whatever, and I try and sell it myself.
Yep.
And we'll see. We'll see if after Becca James Lowenstein, Queen of the Space Pirates, ! Is done, I go back to the second Odd Wings book. Or not. Because both of them, and this feels like a bad idea, like, neither of them are standalones. Like, they both are the start of series.
Mm.
Although Becca James is a little bit more episodic in its nature. But we'll have to see.
Well, I mean, finishing the manuscript, I felt like, you know, I felt like, I want to see what else happens.
Well, yeah, I mean,
I hope there's more.
Literally, the last quote in it is, this is just the beginning. Yeah,
but
which felt a little precious, I suppose.
But it felt like a whole story. It didn't feel like it was incomplete.
It's an origin story.
Yeah.
Which is not, like, and that's, so much about Becca James is very, or is, I'm intending to be very different from how Odd Wings is. Mm. And we'll see how much I can pull that off, or if I don't have that much range. We'll find out. Speaking of such things, last night saw... PBS.
Yeah.
Has an app.
Yeah.
Like a streaming app.
Yeah,
like
I should have that on my phone.
You should, and on your TV, because you don't need anything for it. Like, you have to have an account. But you just give them an email address and a password, and then you tell them, like, you put in a zip code and you pick your local PBS station.
Oh.
But you don't have to have TV or anything like
that.
And then you have all their stuff, and they got a ton of stuff.
Oh.
And it's local to, like, what you are. So the stuff that Iowa Public Television cares you have, and not necessarily what other ones do. But the reason we did this is because we wanted to watch episode of American Masters that was on recently about Ursula K. Le Guin.
Oh.
Called The Worlds of Ursula K. Le Guin.
Awesome.
We watched it last night. I recommend it. It's very cool. It delves into a lot of history. It's before she died. She died in 2018.
Mm.
And so there's a lot of current footage. But in general, this is a lot of footage of her saying things and stuff. And that was very cool.
Mm.
And it sort of takes you through the evolution of her book writing. And it was just neat, and I recommend it. And you also get a little bit more about her family sisters. Like, her father was an extremely important cultural anthropologist.
Oh.
And in fact, he was in the late 19th century, was going around California with wax cylinders and recording language and cultural artifacts of the various California tribes that were disappearing.
Oh, wow.
And eventually finds and makes friends with what is basically the last of a particular tribe.
Oh.
A guy named Ishii, except that wasn't his real name. That was basically his language's word for man, because his culture, you don't give your real name. So that's, and this was a big thing, and they were very famous, and they had all sorts of stuff. And then eventually somebody's like, you should write this into a book. And he's like, I can't do it. And he got his wife to do it. And his wife wrote this book about this experience and all this. And like, yeah, this was a whole thing. And it greatly ends up influencing Le Guin in some of her later stuff. And she's amazing because her writing evolved. She learned and learned like problems with things that she then had with her earlier things. The most obvious one is she wrote earlier stuff, and like most famously the Earthsea trilogy, Wizard of Earthsea, and all those, the young adult books. And then years later, people are like, it's kind of sexist. And she's like, it kind of is. And so then she starts writing other stuff that's not, and sequels to that stuff that sort of answer that, and things that change. And to me, it's all very much, she's doing what she wants to be doing for herself. It's not, because I mean, she was selling like crazy. When she hit, she hit. And so it's not like she needed to change in order to be successful. At that point, she is successful.
Sure.
But she's changing because she wants to change. And I love that. And they get a lot of cool authors in the documentary. Neil Gaiman's in there. China Meville's in there. So yeah, that was very cool too. So I would recommend it.
Were you familiar with her father's work at all?
Not at all.
Oh,
huh. I didn't know any of this jazz.
Hmm.
I knew her family was something with education, because she grew up in Berkeley because they were tied to the university somehow. But yeah, so I would recommend checking that out. In other things, finished season one of Pose. Cannot recommend it high enough. Wonderful show. First season is on Netflix. It is only 8 episodes, and it's fairly self-contained. I mean, the show is going on, and I plan to watch more of it once I can get my hands on it. But if you just watch the first season, it's pretty much a complete arc, and you're fine. It's really good, and what I really found interesting is it's sticking with me in huge ways. I'm thinking about it all the time. And I'm trying to pinpoint why. And I think it is, the show's about relationships, just completely. And it's very focused on the concept of a chosen family and the people that you decide are your family and that you love about and care about.
Found family.
That kind of thing too. Yeah. Which is what the houses were in the ballroom scene, or are in the ballroom scene.
Sure.
But there are so many of these, you know, people, the usual shit that you would have on any sort of melodrama or anything, but I find it so much more fascinating here because in this context it matters so much more, because these are people whose identity is so incredibly marginalized and whose survival is like, whose subsistence is so incredibly on the edge that, you know, like a fight with a friend that screws up that relationship could cause you to be living on the street the next day, or could cause you to, you know, suffer terrible abuse. Like, there's so much.
The stakes are very high.
And that's the thing. And so it really made me think it's just a very heightened version of the, you know, everything you do matters.
Yeah.
And of course, and it's all set in ballroom culture, which is full of throwing shade and stuff like that. And like, friendly or not so friendly rivalries and things like that. Sure. And so there's just layer on layer on layer of this. And so it really sticks out in my head. And it's also just a fucking so well done show. And it's all queer people of color. And that's just marvelous. It's just really good. And it had its moments. Like I talked about before, I spent a long time not watching it because I was worried it was going to be really heart-wrenching for me.
Sure, sure.
it had about 1.5 episodes that like somewhere around like episode 5 or whatever. I was like, oh, and when we finished it, I was like, that's what I was afraid every episode was going to be like. Mm-hmm. But I still loved that episode. It was just that one was hard. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I feel like it's such a positive show. And it's not glossing over the serious stuff, but it's just very good at showing the positive that can come out of this stuff and people growing and learning and relationships changing. And
right.
It's just really good. People watch it. It's really good. It's awesome. We don't realize we're getting excited for stuff because tomorrow Dark Crystal starts on Netflix.
Tomorrow, huh?
Yep, tomorrow, Age of Resistance starts on Netflix. All accounts are, it's awesome. Also tomorrow on Amazon is Carnival Row, which maybe not so awesome, but we'll see. We're excited for it anyway. I talked about The Righteous Gemstones. That's going on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We're actually an episode or so behind. We should maybe watch that. And just a bunch of stuff is coming now. So, and in a few weeks, we'll have new Good Place and stuff like that. So, we're not actively watching anything because we're, like, excited for several things.
Yeah, the fall shows are
it's
coming.
It's weird that still happens.
Yeah, it is.
Stuff happens in the fall, but yeah. As I said, went and saw a play at the Mill.
At the Mill?
And it was a full-length 2-hour play with intermission and everything. They had taken the Mill and turned it into a friggin' theater. It was ridiculous.
Huh.
Like, half the Mill was blocked off because this... Yeah, the production company is called Run of the Mill Productions. And they've been around for a few years, and I've known this, and it was only when I was at this play that I suddenly realized, oh, they call themselves that because they perform at the Mill.
Because
I'm an idiot. this was a play called The Underpants.
The Underpants.
Yes. And it is an adaptation of a 1910 German play called Die Hose, I believe. Same thing. That was adapted in like the 60s by Steve Martin.
Oh.
The performance was wonderful. Everyone did an incredible job. I actually, in the beginning, was trying to sort of figure out who the strong and the weak actors were, and I realized every part was really odd in its special way, and they cast them all perfectly for that. And it was a great time. It was marvelous. I don't think I like the play.
Oh, well. Yeah.
It's a very old farce style, so everything is just goofy, nothing resolves, no one faces any consequence for their good or bad actions. But the basics of the premise of it is we have a very middle-class German couple in 1910 in Berlin.
In Berlin, okay.
He is a mid-level governmental cleric, and she is a housewife.
Okay.
And before the play, they went to a parade to see the king pass. The
Kaiser?
Yes, the Kaiser. While this was happening, the wife's underpants accidentally fell down.
Oh.
Like around her ankles.
That's embarrassing.
And she quickly grabbed them and tucked them away.
Hmm.
And the husband is mortified and is convinced this is a scandal that is going to cost him his job and can't believe she would let this happen and all sorts of things.
Okay.
Meanwhile, this modest middle-class couple has a room to rent and various men, multiple men, show up wanting to rent this room, some of which... maybe because they might have spied what happened and have feelings about it, some of which may or may not be reciprocated, and then just hijinks ensue. It's a sex comedy, basically, but it's a very tame sex comedy. And in fact, part of the humor is that it's way more tame than it sort of, like, lets on. It's one of those things where somebody says they're going to have sex, and then, like, every time it's going to happen, something spoils it, and, you know, that kind of thing. It had some actors that I knew from other local productions I've seen that do great jobs. My friend was in it, and she was marvelous. It's very funny for her because she's a very sort of modest, clean-cut sort of person in her way.
Mm.
and she was playing an incredibly vulgar, gossipy neighbor who said lines that, like, earlier she'd said, like, there's some lines that if I had read the script before, and I probably wouldn't have gone for this part. And I was like, oh my God. And then I'm like, no, I can see that you would have had trouble with that. But she did wonderfully. She did really great. But so that was fun. But yeah, I don't think I like the play. It's dumb. And it's old, and the adaptation doesn't make it. They do think, like, I get the sense that the original probably had a lot of anti-Semitic humor in it.
Mm.
Because this one has a lot of humor laughing at certain characters for being anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, yeah, I'll bet that got adapted. Just dumb stuff like that. But it was, this performance of it was really fun. So, that's all. I mean, we're almost out of time already. Have you got anything you need to talk about from the week?
Nope.
It was not an exciting week for you?
Well, I read your book.
That's true. You can't ask for more than that. You can't have had a more exciting time than that.
We did do other things, but that
I don't.
That was the thing that was the most important thing to me. Okay. This is long.
Mm.
And it's not abridged or anything. It's the whole...
Oh, my goodness.
Thing, and the letters are very small, so I hope I can
read
them. The
hat must have been feeling charitable.
And it's signed, definitely not Azure Talon, which probably means it's Azure Talon.
Fuck. All right.
Hat guys. Multi-part question. Yeah, I imagine so. What street did you grow up on? What's your mother's maiden name? What was your childhood pet's name? Who was your first best friend? Asking for research. Definitely not Azure Talon. These are obviously security questions that you put
except,
in things.
But they're not. Like, to me, some of them are.
The maiden name one, for
but
sure.
But mostly...
Street you grew up on, for sure.
These are the questions by which you determine... Like I think that's what he's going for. No, these are the questions by which you determine both your drag queen name and your porn name.
No.
Yes. Your drag queen name is the name of your childhood pet and your mother's maiden name. And your porn name is, I believe, your middle name and the name of the street you grew up on.
That doesn't work at all for me.
No, these mine work really well.
What's your mother's maiden name? That's one. Your pet's name or your best friend. I don't know. I think the street you grew up on, that might be
it
one.
It can be. There's a lot of security questions. I mean, I think that's the joke he's getting at. But what I'm saying is he conveniently picked the ones that are really good for that. They happen to work perfectly for me.
Well, what are they?
My drag queen name is either, because we had two pets, either Molly Pennington or Mitzi Pennington. And I feel like both of those are good drag queen names.
You're kind of right.
And my porn name is Kent Woodlawn. I mean...
What?
Right? Right?
I think you're making that up.
No, what's funny is I remember playing this game in college, and there was a problem because... Some friend the street he grew up on was Old Mexico Road, and we were like, "That's not a good last name for porn."
No. I keep forgetting your middle name's Kent.
Kent.
I was talking, the Oldsmobile fan. His middle name's Kent.
My father's middle name is Kent, but he goes by his middle name.
Oh, okay.
And so me and my brother also have the middle name Kent. And I thought this was a tradition that we would all carry on, and I was excited for it when I had a kid, but then I didn't have a kid. But then my brother cheated, and so his first son has his first name as his middle name. Mm. My brother's first name is his middle name, mm-hmm. Alan. And then their second son has his wife's first name as his middle name. And then their third one, I think they just made some shit up. I don't even remember.
Oh, wow. So he had three tries at it. And he
yeah,
didn't
and
name
I'm
any
just,
of
that was, him. Like, I was, I, this used to be a thing that, like, really bugged me. Because for some reason, I was like, this is the one legacy thing that I'm into. And that and the fact that he changed his last name because he took his wife's last name, which in principle I am absolutely in favor of, but I'm like, this is the only Parsons who can pass the name on.
Yeah.
And all the other ones in our extended family, I don't want them giving us our reputation. But
I didn't grow up on a street. My road didn't even have a name.
Oh my God. Well, then you're one of those like single name porn stars like Sancho.
Okay, whatever.
Are you Sancho? Is Scott Baio Sancho?
Although, you know, there was this program, or has been, in Iowa anyway, probably all over, to make it easier to answer 911 calls.
Yeah. They got rid of the rural routes. So they got real addresses.
Yes. So now the road does have a name.
Yes. No, I know, because this was becoming a thing when I was working at one of the many newspapers I worked at. So transitioning them over was a major part of my job.
Yeah, it's called Quaker Drive now. See, no. I see your face.
Yeah, no, it's not. What's your middle name again?
Charles.
Charles Quaker Drive. Yeah, I'm not feeling it.
No. Nope.
It sounds like maybe, like, that sounds like the name of a porn star from, like, the silent movie era. Which, they made porns back then.
Silent porn star.
Featuring handsome heartthrob Charles Quaker Drive.
I'm feeling very uncomfortable with this.
My best friend grow. That's a really weird one, because I had a lot. I mean, when you're a kid, I feel like this is the thing. Like, you switch best friends all the friggin' time.
But my mom's maiden name's Hoffman, and my pet's name was Sam.
Sam Hoffman?
That doesn't sound like a drag queen to me.
Sounds like a good drag king name.
You know, it kind of does now that you mention it. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
Because for drag queens, they don't typically pick first names that even if they're female, like Samantha, are shortened to a male, because that kind of defeats the purpose.
No, exactly. They tend to be intensely feminine. Much feminism. Oh, wow. No, they tend to be very feminine and frequently play on words or double entendre. And also just fabulous, which I can't describe any better than that. I recently was looking into the background of the various actors on Pose, and some of their histories are fascinating.
The actors themselves?
Yes. Of the main characters that are trans women, two are actually trans women, and one identifies as non-binary in real life and uses they, their pronouns, mm-hmm. and is apparently, according to interviews they've been in, tends to be seen as a cis woman. I don't know what their biological situation is, but the other, like, one of them started off as a model. And because she's very tall and statuesque. And in fact, I found out that there was a short run reality show, not a competition, but just like a look into the lives of kind of reality show.
Yeah.
Of basically a whole bunch of trans models that were trying to make it. And she was on this, and I want to find it now. I found details about it, but I haven't found a place to see it. And that a bunch of them, even though it's later than the series, it was more like in the 90s when it happened, quite a lot of them actually did grow up involved in the ballroom scene in New York, because it still exists now. And so that was really interesting. And then, like, yeah, a couple, one of the characters who just plays a man is just a man in real life, but, like, his whole career has been very focused on his issues with toxic masculinity and masculine assumptions and all that, and he works really hard to fight against that, which is really interesting, because to me in the show he's like one of the butchest characters in the show, but again sort of plays around with that, and like a character who's very focused on dance in the show is a professional dancer and all that. And of course Billy Porter, who I don't know why I was like worried, because I knew Billy Porter was in this and he's been in the news so much lately and all this, and I was worried because I knew what role he was sort of playing and that he would be a side character. No, he's a major character in the show and he's amazing. Love him to death. The mainest main character named Blanca is played by a woman named MJ Rodriguez, and I have such a crush on her. I had a crush on her when she was playing Ebony in Saturday Church. Ugh. Anyway, that's it for time. So, yeah, I think that's all the questions. So go ahead and, you know, set up credit cards in our name or whatever you're going to do, Azure Talon. And
I don't use any of those security questions, by the way. Not any of those. There's lots of options, and you can write your own even, and I usually pick something that is going to be more obscure than that stuff.
I knew of someone who has an answer for all security questions, like a single answer that it has nothing to do with the context of the questions. Uh-huh. And that way they never forget, depending on what it
and
is.
And also nobody's going
to
guess
exactly, because it's really arbitrary related to them.
That's
I kind of
like
that idea. I just have security questions that I'm like, I don't know anybody else, even in my life, who would remember the answer to that. And I do. Because it's all the things, you know how when there are weird memories that just stick with you for some reason?
Yeah.
Like the shit I remember from when I was three for no reason? Yeah. It's I only take those. So, like, if it's a question about a teacher, it's a teacher, like, there's a bunch of teachers. I'm like, what teacher was that with? And then there's one that I'm like, no, I absolutely remember her name. I was very young. There's no reason I should. No one else remembers, but I remember that one. Or things like that, like, which pet? Well, there's one pet that I always think of when I do that, and it wasn't necessarily my first pet, or, like, but there's one that just is the pet I use. And
well, I never use
like
my
that.
Mom's maiden name because it's so easy to find out what my mom's maiden name is. Super easy. I mean, on Facebook, I'm not on Facebook anymore, but there's an Aether Theater page on Facebook, and my siblings are on Facebook, and they post pictures of my mom and her name and as a memorial all the time. So everybody knows my mom.
And everybody
maiden name.
Knows you're related to Jesus because of the theater. So that's jumping right there.
So yeah, so. I never use that because not that anyone would care to steal my identity of all things.
Sure they will. It's a free social security number.
Yeah, I suppose.
You can do all sorts of shit with that. Anyway, if you'd like to steal our identity, write about it on the blog, themagicaltalkinghat.com. Also, write in, because we need more stuff. We always need more stuff. We need stuff. There's only like 5 of you listening anymore, so you're going to have to up your game. themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com.
Up your games.
No, they're playing one. They're playing a zone defense against us. Also, come back and listen next week, because otherwise, what is... Huh?
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.